Island.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Good evening. You are listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we're recording part of a series on the intersection of trans and non-binary identities and the intersection with disability. So my name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Nicolette and I use AM or they, them pronouns.
I'm Carter and I use they, them pronouns.
Thank you. So this evening, we're going to be starting with part of a series of conversations with folks in the community who are going to be telling their stories from their own authentic places about what the unique issues are that people who are trans, non-binary, and disabled have to struggle with in a world where people sometimes erase or make invisible their disabilities. And we're going to try as much as we can to really locate the conversation within the lived experiences of people authentically telling their stories without judgment, especially without judgment or without anything other than authentically listening. So this idea started with Carter. So Carter, can you tell us a little bit about your idea for this series of conversations?
Yeah, so I want to bring awareness to the fact that in the medical and healthcare system, whether that be mental or physical health, that trans people are not seen and not heard. And I wanted to just talk about different people's experiences, especially for people of different age ranges, and if they like live in different places, if they lived on like the other side of the country, or if they've only lived in a small city. And so I was hoping that we could all talk about that.
Carter, I know that we've had you on Transpositive before, but just to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about your story? Could you tell us who you are and, you know, it's just so people could get to know you a little bit better?
Yeah, so I am 20 and I identify as gender fluid. I came out in high school in 2016-2017. In my trans identity, and since coming out, I have faced battles with homelessness in the emergency medical system with EMS services, and when I've gone inpatient for both physical and mental health, how I was treated badly. There were some good experiences. There are some great doctors out there, great professionals out there who will lift up my voice when I am not heard. But overall, I have faced many challenges, specifically with emergency services regarding my seizure disorder that I developed when I was 17. I started getting seizures out of the blue, and I was having about 150 seizures a day, where I would drop to the ground and convulse, and that would happen during the day and during the night. And because I was living in a transitional housing program, they would call 911 even when it was not needed, and I did not need to go. And during this journey of trying to find care, I now know how to lift up my own voice, and I want to help others be able to lift up their voices within the medical system.
Thank you. And Nicolette, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us your story as it relates to this conversation?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm Nicolette. I'm 30, and I identify as non-binary. I came out as bisexual when I was 13, later changed the label to pansexual when I was 18, but I actually didn't come out as non-binary until my mid-20s. Like, I think I was around 24. And as far as my disabilities go, that's something I've struggled with my entire life. I was born with nonverbal learning disorder, which affects, you know, my motor skills, my social skills, my ability to do math, like a bunch of things. And I was also born with ADHD, Tourette's, OCD, you know, so I was dealing with these pretty serious disabilities as a little kid. And on top of that, because I was traumatized by my abusive parents and my being bullied a lot for my disabilities, you know, that led to me developing some psychological disabilities as well, like PTSD, bipolar, borderline personality disorder. I've got multiple anxiety disorders, you know, I've got a bunch going on. And that also kind of triggered me developing lupus when I was 16. A lot of people don't know this, but lupus, while there is a genetic predisposition to it, it's often triggered by stress. So because I was dealing with so much stress, I developed that in my teen years. And I've definitely had to deal with a lot of people not understanding my disabilities and treating me really badly because of them. I've had to deal with teachers not really knowing how to accommodate me, and at times just straight up putting me down because, you know, they thought I was stupid or lazy or not working hard enough. I've had to deal with doctors who didn't know how to treat me, and, you know, oftentimes just thought that it was all in my head. Like, I remember when my lupus started developing, I basically, you know, went to several different doctors. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, and, you know, basically said, well, what if it's just in your head? What if you're just depressed? Things like that. So a particular intersection I've noticed between my disabilities and my trans identity is a lot of people don't take me seriously. They already don't take me seriously because I'm disabled and because I'm non-binary, but especially because of the fact that I have mental disabilities. I've seen a lot of people just assume, first of all, that being trans is just a mental illness, or it's just something neurodivergent people think they are. And, you know, that's why I've had so many people, once they hear that I'm trans, they just either accuse me of being mentally ill or mentally disabled, or if they know that I am mentally ill and mentally disabled, they say it's just because of that. I just think that I'm something I'm not. And I can go into more detail about that, but that's just kind of an overview of my experience with being trans and being disabled.
Thank you. I'd really like to come back to that, Nicolette. Carter, is there anything that Nicolette has said that resonates with you that you're hearing in Nicolette's experience that, you know, you can relate to?
Yeah, I think that the thing that I like that popped out to me almost instantly was when they had said that it was caused like the trigger, right? It was stress. Stress can trigger these things that you like in your genetics that you can have. While it does not cause the problem, it can trigger it. And stress can trigger a lot of different symptoms. And a lot of people don't understand that stress can play a big role in, are you having like a high stress day? Could you be also having a high symptom day? Or if you're more stressed, do you not see as many symptoms because you're focused on other stuff? So I've seen that too. But for me, doctors were just saying that I was just too stressed. And that's why I was having my seizures. And I can tell you, when you are just sleeping, laying in bed sleeping, that that the last thing that you would think was I just had a seizure in my sleep because of stress. Like, yeah, and so seizures can be brought on by stress, a lot of different symptoms. Pain can be brought on by stress. I thinking about stress as a whole, I would say that it can be managed, but that's not going to make other symptoms go away.
Thank you. And Nicolette, was there anything that you heard in Carter's initial discussion that resonated with you?
Yeah. I mean, I think we both kind of relate to doctors not fully understanding how to treat us and not fully understanding what exactly is going on with us. I think that's something that both of us have touched on. And I also want to go back to something we had brought up earlier as to whether the locations that we live in affects the way that we're treated. And I've definitely noticed a huge difference between when I grew up in this small town that was very conservative. And so people there were very discriminatory towards anyone LGBT and also anyone with disabilities. So I was bullied very severely there. I had teachers who just were not willing to work with me, etc. Versus when I moved to a larger city that's much more liberal, I feel like I'm, you know, I still have some of the same problems, but I'm finding a lot more acceptance here. When I started going to college, I found professors were much more willing to accommodate me. The school was much more willing to work with my issues. And I think that that's, you know, a huge difference I've noticed between living in a very conservative rural area versus a much more liberal area. It really does affect the way that you're treated and perceived by people.
Thank you. So over the course of, several interviews, we hope to talk with many, trans and non-binary people who have different levels of storytelling that they need to share both with each other and with the broader community about the ways in which trans and non-binary people are discriminated and misunderstood both by medical care providers and also by the broader public. And the kind of stress and anxiety and problem that this causes to have disabilities that are not recognized and not understood and not validated by both trans people such as myself who are able-bodied within a certain kind of framework, and also by the broader community. So first, I just really want to acknowledge that your voices here are really the prioritized voices. And it's really, I really hope that whoever is listening to the show this week will understand the unique gift that we have in being able to hear you tell us what is going on in your lives and things that we really need to know. So I just like to say that for starters. We do have a couple of other interviews that we're hoping to get on the radio, including with Erin and with Misty. But we recognize that people are in different spaces. And when you're trans, non-binary, and you also are dealing with chronic pain, with stress and anxiety, and with the incredible difficulty of just surviving from day to day, that you're not always in the right place for being visible, because being visible is a very vulnerable place to be. So I just want to acknowledge that. I do have some questions I'd like to ask you from my perspective as an outsider, because I don't know everything about the world that you are in. I mean, I've spoken with both of you. I've had you on the show before, but I don't know what it's like to be you. And so, but one of the themes that I've seen from other people who are interested in participating in the panel is a discussion about just how much work it is to deal day to day with the varying levels of pain and stress and just the incredible amount of effort it takes just to get into a space every day where you're able to, you know, deal with the world. And I'm wondering if each of you can talk about that from your perspectives. Like, how do you have to adjust? And what kind of work do you have to do just to be in a place where you're even ready to say, have a conversation like this?
Yeah, I can go first if you want. A great way that I've seen this explained to able-bodied people is something called spoon theory. This was actually created by a woman with lupus like I have. The conversation came about when she was out at a diner with her friend, and the friend basically asked the same kind of question you did. What is it like to live day to day with your chronic illness? So the woman with lupus, she grabs a bunch of spoons that are just sitting around the diner, and she says, picture this. You only have a certain amount of spoons for the day. That's all the spoons you get, and the spoons represent how much energy you have. And every single thing you do, no matter how tiny it is, requires some amount of spoons. If, let's say, just getting out of bed is a spoon. Let's say taking a shower is 3 spoons. Making yourself a meal is 2 spoons. You know, whatever, how much energy it feels like to you. So you have to plan out every single thing you do in a certain day to make sure that you have enough spoons to do it all. And sometimes that number of spoons may be more or less depending on how you're feeling that day. Maybe you're having a good day where you're not having a whole lot of pain, you have a good amount of energy, you may have more spoons, you may be able to get more things done. You may wake up one day and have a really bad day, you may be in a lot of pain and have almost no energy. So you've got like very little spoons to work with. And so you're not going to be able to get as much done that day. And you have to think very carefully about, you know, what am I able to do today? Am I able to make myself meals? Am I able to shower and get dressed? Just even these tiny little things that I think a lot of able-bodied people don't think about. And that's just, you know, for... It doesn't just apply to chronic illness, I think. That can also apply to just, you know, how much of a toll my mental disabilities can take on me as well. Because, you know, with having anxiety, with having learning disabilities, all of this, you know, even just mentally, it's all so exhausting to do anything. Physically, it's exhausting to do everything with my lupus. So a lot of times, like I said, it just takes planning out you know, how am I feeling today? Do I have enough energy to do this and this and this? And I have to kind of check in with myself throughout the day, see how I'm feeling, see if I'm still able to keep doing everything I planned. But I also just have to take care of myself a lot, give myself as much rest as I can to do the things I need, take care of my body, and take care of myself mentally, make sure that I'm using the appropriate coping skills for all of my mental illnesses and my mental disabilities, you know, and especially with having learning disabilities, I really have to navigate the world in a way that, you know, I have to put things in a perspective that makes sense to me. Navigating literally every single thing in the world is in my life, and it is exhausting mentally and physically.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Carter, would you care to address that question?
Yeah, so for me, I also use the spoon theory. It can be very hard for me to transfer because I am in a wheelchair. It's hard for me to transfer to my bed, to the toilet, to my shower. And I just had to have bladder surgery because I have interstitial cystitis, which is also known as painful bladder syndrome, which gives you the feeling as if you were to have UTIs like 10 times worse than what you could imagine, plus like as if you had like kidney infections too, and all of that. It's a very painful condition for me, and I was going to the bathroom over 20 times a day, and now like I'm able to go 10 to 15 times a day, which people would be like, wow, that's a lot, and it is a lot. But it's something that I had to do to make sure then I can put my energy towards something else and not have to just be by a bathroom all of the time. And for me, I would rather like clump everything into a day than like have appointments like spread out over a week. So I try to clump all of my appointments all together because I have anywhere from like five to seven appointments in a 7-day period. And I like to clump those in as much as I possibly can so that I do have a day where I can just fully lay in bed, or I would be sitting in my chair for, you know, most of the day, and it's not very comfortable sitting in a wheelchair that isn't made for you. I currently have a power chair, so it's a lot easier to now go places. So having mobility equipment that fits your needs is super important, and I think a lot of doctors are hesitant to hand out medical equipment, including wheelchairs and walkers and canes and feeding tubes to people because they cause the stigma that if you are disabled and you look disabled, that's a bad thing. And it's not. Mobility equipment and medical equipment is so important so that we can live full lives. I used to have a walker, and I am now like 110 times more able to do stuff than I could with a walker when I could walk, because I was in so much more pain and I couldn't get anywhere, which then would cause my seizures and my brain fog, and it was this awful cycle. And now I have to think, is it a high pain day? Is it a high seizure day for me? If either one of those are too much, I will cancel my appointments. Because I would rather reschedule than be in pain all day long.
Thank you, Carter. So part of what I'm hearing is that having access to the mobility devices that are necessary are really essential for being visible and for being able to navigate through the day easily. And part of the role of doing that effectively, as you've said, Carter, is to have medical providers who understand the importance of that role in folks who need it. And part of what I'm hearing from you, Nicolette, is that people who are able-bodied sometimes don't understand how important it is not to look at the world through their framework, but rather to just put all of that aside and to listen to whoever they're in communication with and to not have prior assumptions that are based on being able-bodied. So one of the things that's come up in the conversations that we've had prior to this is, because this show is about gender identity, this is about transgender, non-binary identities, what kind of overlapping stress is there working within the medical institution, within the psychiatric care institutions, within day-to-day life, around being both disabled and being trans or non-binary? For instance, the members of our group who's had prior conversations before this recording has talked about how they've been misgendered almost half of the time when they're going through medical care. How does that add stress to your life? And can you talk about how your gender identity intersects with your disabled identities?
Yeah, so for me, in 2020, I had experienced psychosis for the first time, and I was needing to go inpatient to a facility. And at that point, I was begging to go into a facility so that I would get better, because you know, that's what you think. I'm going to a facility. They're going to make me better. I'm going to learn stuff. I'm going to get stabilized. And for the first day, it was pretty okay. However, I had asked them, I was like, I take testosterone. I need that today because I was transferred there on a Monday, and Mondays are when I do my testosterone shots. And I have never missed a day doing my testosterone shot. And I'd been doing it for over a year. And I had only missed it twice, and it was at that facility because they said that they don't carry testosterone for the patients, that they've never needed to do that. And I had to wait a day because of that. But I had a seizure at that facility, and so they didn't let me take my testosterone because I had a seizure, and the doctor was telling them that my seizures were fake, and that I was just being non-compliant and needed to be at the more restrictive or most restrictive hallway that they had, and that was awful. And after that, I was just like, you know, I want to get better. I want to get better. I'm going to stay until I'm better. And I had more seizures and more seizures, and which with each one, they treated me worse and worse. And when the court had dropped the hold that they had on me, and I had decided to leave AMA because I couldn't take it anymore, and that stress didn't help with the symptoms that I was experiencing, and and then not being able to get my testosterone shot just really messed with me mentally, because I'm like, I need this. This is something that I need in my care, and I am not getting this. And I would cry. I would just cry for hours sitting in the shower because I'm not getting the one thing that I need at that time.
Nicolette, do you have any stories about how you're treated or the ways in which you're treated as a non-binary person when you're receiving medical care?
Yeah, I do want to say Carter's story is very shocking to me, and I know my story is probably much more mild as someone who's not physically transitioning. But I do definitely deal with getting misgendered a lot. You know, I frequently have doctors referring to me as a woman and referring to me as female. I have in recent years, I think in the past couple of years, noticed that a lot of times when I go to doctor's appointments now and I have to fill out forms, they do sometimes have an option where I can, you know, they'll ask for sex and gender separately. And so I have the option to list my sex as female, which it is, but then I can list my gender as non-binary. And I really appreciate that. But even then, a lot of doctors, even if they see that on the form, they'll still misgender me. They'll still refer to me as a woman and female and such when, you know, I'm literally putting it on the form here. I am non-binary. Please don't refer to me as a woman. And, you know, it's still, I think, is a lot of doctors just can't seem to get that through their heads, or they're having a hard time grasping it. So, you know, I may not have had such extreme experiences, but I do definitely deal with getting misgendered a lot by doctors.
So one of the, in the conversations that we had prior to the preparation for the show tonight, one of the things that kept coming up in the conversation was the role that getting misgendered plays in adding to the stresses of the already stressful position of going through the medical or behavioral health institutions. So like the stories that I've heard were, I'm in pain, I have to face surgery, I have to face seeing a psychiatrist or a therapist, and I'm feeling stress and anxiety. I'm not sure what's going to be happening. I have to deal with multiple medical professionals and assistants and caregivers. And on top of that, I'm getting misgendered. And that sounds profoundly painful and disorienting. Would either of you care to comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely feel that sort of compounded pain of, you know, I'm already dealing with so much pain and stress because of my disabilities. And on top of that, I'm dealing with pain and stress because I'm getting misgendered all the time. And it feels like I can't take a break. And when I have to go see a doctor and I'm getting misgendered while I'm also in pain, you know, I'm having to deal with so much at once. And it just adds to my stress even more.
Carter, how is your situation resolved with not getting testosterone, crying from, you know, being so mistreated and, you know, being neglected the care that you deserve. How was that situation resolved?
I had talked to one of the doctors that was there, and they ended up like getting me my testosterone, but it was after a couple of days that they had given me my testosterone, which can really throw some things off in your body if you don't have it. And at that time, I was still getting estrogen from my ovaries because I still had those. I now don't have ovaries or a uterus, so I wouldn't be able to, like, make... If I went off of testosterone, I would still have hormones in my body. But if that were to happen to me now, that would really cause havoc in my body, which can hormone imbalance can make my symptoms get worse, whether that is my pain increasing, hot flashes, brain fog, you know, feeling hungry but not being able to eat. And I notice it a lot also with medical providers that before I had a beard, I was continuously misgendered, and I still am. I use they them pronouns, and doctors you know, see me as male presenting, so they think that they can then use he, him pronouns, which, you know, I find better than she, her, but it still hurts me because it's in my chart. These are doctors that have known me for a while, that I've worked with them for a couple of years, a couple of months, and I would have thought that they would be understanding of, like, how my pronouns aren't he, him, and I do get uncomfortable using that even though I look male presenting.
Another item that came up in our conversations prior to tonight's recording was the difficulties of being poor and being on a program like, for instance, OHP, and trying to get appropriate care as somebody who's both trans or non-binary and also dealing with complex medical diagnoses, such as your situation, Carter, or your situation, Nicola. I am not going to ask you to disclose what your health insurance status is or what your level of care is, but have you heard stories from your fellow trans and non-binary friends in the community, or do you have personal experiences to relate about difficulties with getting care or maintaining continuity of care under either OHP or another insurance program, or even just difficulty with getting insurance that will adequately cover the needs that you have?
Yeah, I actually have been dealing with that quite recently, where I've had multiple treatments that I needed or multiple tests that needed to be done that my health insurance wouldn't cover. And, you know, I'm very poor. I'm on disability cash assistance. And so I can't afford to cover those treatments myself. And so I'm going without treatments that I need because my insurance won't cover them and I can't pay for them.
Yeah, I've definitely seen it a lot in my care too. I have now seen six neurologists, I believe, trying to get care for my seizures, my migraines, my movement disorder, and trying to find a doctor that will do all three has been hell. Because I would go to a doctor and it would seem like, oh yeah, everything's going so great. And then I see them again and they do misgender me, and they make it a point that because I was born female, that it is just all mental health, because females to them have more mental problems. So I would quickly leave and try to find another doctor, which you would then have to go back to your primary care, get a referral to a new clinic, wait months to go to that new clinic, see if it works. And I had seen a doctor for my seizures, because he is, I'm not gonna say it because it's a fancy doctor for seizures specifically. And I just wanted care for my migraines. I was like, I don't really care if you want to talk about my seizures. I am here because of my migraines and I need something to stop it. And it felt like everything was going good and everything was going good. And then the stuff with my movement happened and ending up in a wheelchair, and he didn't want me to have a wheelchair because it would set me back from walking. Note, I haven't walked since April. And because I thought that I found a good doctor because he did good care with like my migraines, and he wouldn't use they them pronouns, but he was more accepting of me being transgender than previous doctors. And so I then was sent to a movement specialist, and I was like, can you please take over all of my care regarding the neurological stuff? And she said that she would. So that's kind of where I am at now, because there is no other doctor that I could see for my movement problems. There's no doctor at Legacy in Oregon that does it. She actually works at Good Sam and in Salmon Creek in Vancouver. So she doesn't normally work out of Good Sam. She's normally in Vancouver, so she would technically be in a different state. And because when you have certain insurance, you can't go to other hospitals. So for me, I have Pacific Source. So I can go to any Legacy provider or any provider that's not in the Legacy system that takes Pacific Source. But if, you know, there's no doctor that takes Pacific Source, now I'm going to have to switch my insurance so that I can see a doctor at a different hospital that does, because I need to get that other care.
And then you might lose the connections to the doctors and cares that were covered by your previous insurance that you needed for something different.
Yeah.
So you're constantly experiencing gaps in coverage, gaps in care, gaps in treatment.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I again, referring to our, by the way, this is Transpositive. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we're talking with folks as part of a continuing conversation on issues that affect trans and non-binary folks who are disabled and have to rely on different levels of care within the medical community, and some of the issues that come up around continuity of care, being misgendered while you're receiving treatment, how overlying issues of poverty and public assistance and just gaps in coverage like affect the health and well-being of trans and non-binary folks. And we have Nicolette and Carter with us tonight, and we're going to hopefully have some other folks, Aaron and Misty, on a different show. Have you had any negative experiences with receiving care as someone who is transgender, disabled, at various medical institutions in Portland? What have your negative experiences been?
Yes. So I actually had OHSU insurance before I switched to Legacy. So OHSU has a gender clinic, which from I've gone to SMIRC, which is the Sexuality and Gender Youth Minority Resource Center here in Portland, and they have different like clinics at the different places for care. So they do have like transgender clinics for hormone replacement therapy, for surgery referrals, and I have heard from those clinics that at OHSU that it's actually a fairly good clinic, that people are happy with that. But getting regular care, whether that is specialty care or through like primary care clinics, it's not so great. For me, I had, I believe, two doctors at OHSU that I did not like. It was the first doctor, and he for my seizures said that it was just all stress, and that I needed that, and told my mom and my sister that if I have a seizure to leave me alone. And I'm in the event of me going to the ER, whether or not it was for a seizure or a different problem, they would misgender me. They put it in that you know, I'm a frequent flyer, and to send me to the waiting room. And they've done that at Legacy as well. When I go to the emergency room via EMS, whether or not I am conscious and alert, I am sent to the waiting room at both places.
Do either of you feel like there are things that are positive that people can also kind of, you know, have a little bit of hope around? Like, for instance, are people who have both trans or non-binary identities and
disabled,
do you feel that they're getting more recognized within the broader community, or is it mostly just, you know, still a lot of hard work and a lot of challenges in front of us?
Well, I do think that we still have a long way to go, but we have definitely made progress. You know, I think just the fact that we have the option to list our gender identities on our paperwork, like I was talking about, I think that is progress. Because a few years ago, I wasn't seeing that. And now in the past couple of years, I'm seeing that more and more. So I think that we are starting to be recognized more. And I think there are more and more doctors who are willing to listen to us and, you know, properly gender us, see us as we are. But it's slow progress. We're gonna get there, I think. But it's gonna take a while.
Yeah. There definitely is still a lot to get done. But yeah, putting down, you know, what your gender identity is, and your pronouns is really important. And I think that that should be like next to your name on all of these forms, including like if you end up going to the hospital and having to get a hospital bracelet, whether you're going in for like a one test or a big surgery, having your pronouns and your name that you go by on the bracelet, and to for some people they still have to sadly have their dead name on their bracelets, which I wish they could just put, you know, the preferred name. But I have seen where they do put the name on like legal paperwork and then the name that you go by on the bracelet, which I also think that that is super important, putting the name that you go by and your pronouns like right next to on top of all of the other information.
Thank you. And Nicolette and Carter, as an able-bodied trans woman, I mean, I personally would like to know, what can able-bodied queers do to be more supportive and to be better allies to our trans and non-binary, like, members of our community who work with, who deal every day with being disabled and all of the issues that we've talked about tonight? How can we who are queer and able-bodied within the queer community be better allies to you?
I think that you should, an example is I cannot, as a wheelchair user, go up and down stairs. And I have friends who I'm just teaching because they're like, oh, I'm gonna go down the stairs, it's quicker. That's you know, hidden ableist comments, because they, you know, they're not thinking it. They're just like, this is what I normally do. And I have to be like, no, you're coming down in the elevator with me because I don't have a choice. That choice is taken away from me and it makes me feel bad for myself, because I used to be able to go up and downstairs pretty easily. And yeah, it is just frustrating with like small comments like those. So if you are with a disabled friend, to be aware that, you know, if we're taking the elevator, it's probably for a reason. If, you know, we're going this certain path and, you know, the disabled friend is like leading the way, that's because that's the path that they can go. And they know the path that they can go. But also for you to keep an eye out for if you go to a certain place and very frequently and someone comes in and is needing to like get to the bathroom, that, you know, maybe you know where the accessible bathroom is, and being able to help like show them the way to the accessible bathroom.
Thank you. Nicolette, what about for people who are queer or trans or non-binary who are neurotypical? How can those of us who fall into that category be better allies for our trans and non-binary community and our that is neurodivergent and has, like, you know, for instance, psychiatric diagnoses or is just neurodivergent in other ways? How can we be better allies?
I mean, one thing that occurs to me is not making assumptions about what we can or can't do. You know, on one hand, I'll deal with neurotypicals just assuming that I should be able to do a math problem in my head, for example, or assuming that I'm stupid and can't do something when I actually can. I think it's very important to not make assumptions and just straight up ask, hey, are you able to do this? Or ask, does such and such work for you. And I think that's all. That also applies to keeping triggers in mind. If you have a type of neurodivergence that can be triggered or affected by something like, say, sensory sensitivity issues or PTSD issues, it's important to listen to someone when they ask, hey, can you not talk about this because it triggers me? Hey, can you turn down the volume on this noise or whatever? Can we not eat at a certain place because of sensory issues? You know, it's important to listen to us and take those things seriously and not just assume that, you know, we're faking it for attention or whatever. It's something that is important to us.
Thank you. Well, I really look forward to our future conversations. I hope that next time we do the show that Misty and Aaron are able to join us, and also Niam, because I know that they've all said that they're really interested. And we really appreciate everyone's willingness to participate in these series of ongoing conversations. I think that I personally understand that you're not always up for it, and then sometimes you are. And I'm really glad that you were both able to join us tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Carter. Thanks for your leadership and getting these conversations started. And I look forward to having more conversations with other members of our panel as they're able to.
Yeah.
So thanks, everyone. You've been listening to Transpositive. Do you have any last items you'd like to share with us before we go tonight, Carter or Nicolette?
I don't know if there's much I want to say because we've covered so much, but, you know, I think that it's important to note that everyone experiences being disabled differently and everyone experiences being trans differently. These experiences are so individual to, you know, each particular person. And so I think, you know, it's important to understand that we may have similarities, we may experience similar things to each other, but at the same time, don't make assumptions that everyone's experience is going to be the same. It's different for everyone.
Thank you. Do you have any last words, Carter?
Yeah, it really is just person by person, and there's no... It's not bad to ask questions in regards to, are you having a high pain day? Do you want to go out? Are you able to do this? Those questions are totally okay to ask and are much appreciated, because we... And a lot of us feel as if we can't say, hey, I can't do this. And it makes us feel good, and it makes us feel powerful to be able to be like, yeah, I'm kind of having a bad day. I don't think that I can do this. Or I am having a great day. Let's go to the zoo.
Great. Well, on that note, you've been listening to Transpositive here on KBO Community Radio. And thank you so much, Carter and Nicolette, for joining us tonight.
are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop, so you keep it locked.
I'm Eddie Zane.
And I'm Helen Zia.
And we are on Hard Knock Radio.
I just want to say peace and blessings upon everybody. This is Michelle and Dege Ocello, and I'm just trying to have a peaceful journey on